You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. One of Us is a podcast and video network funded all but entirely by donations and subscriptions. We do accept pitches for audio-based or banner ads, but on a case-by-case basis. If you're interested in that, contact us at oneofusnet@gmail.com. With the amount of audio and video content we generate, it is expensive and extremely time-consuming to keep things running. Please go to the webpage oneofus.net and sign up for a subscription at $2, $5, $10, or $25 and get a ton of bonus content. One of Us needs and appreciates all your support. I gotta admit, I'm kind of sad that this is the last time this particular group is getting together to talk about this series of documentaries, because we are on the third and final one of the Time Warp, the greatest cult films of all time documentary series.
Memories all alone in the moonlight, which in theory, that movie will also become a cult one, because it's also did really poorly and has...
All right, Harmony, you owe me $10. Mindy started singing in under a minute.
I should have taken that bet.
I am joined by Harmony, as you could hear there. Say hello, Harmony.
Hello, how is everybody?
Everybody can't hear you quite yet.
We're doing good, Harmony. Thanks for asking.
Oh, it's been such a long time of doing this, guys.
And Mindy?
Hello. Do you want me to sing some more? Because I have a whole repertoire.
No, not unless it is specifically called for, and even then.
I don't have enough money.
I'll give you the signal when it's time to start singing.
Okay.
And I will give you the signal when it's time to stop. And then Adrian.
Hello. I can sing too if you want me to.
There's a whole new list of types of cult films to discuss this time. This is called Comedy and Camp. Cult is a strong word for a lot of these, because so many of these are like, yes, while they didn't perform well initially, have become where, you know, they're so incredibly widely seen by everyone that it's hard to even think of them as cult anymore. And then the second half is campy, and those are the ones that just felt like, oh, well, this is the stuff we didn't have time for in the first entry Midnight Movies. And then it has, of all things, only one movie they consider a modern cult film worth talking about, but we will get to all that. We'll go through these movie by movie, and we're going to start off with the film Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Fast Times, and I had totally forgotten about this. I remember years ago reading about this, finding out that it was based on a nonfiction book that Cameron Crowe wrote in 1981, where he was like 23 and he went undercover as a high schooler into an LA high school.
Was he fighting crime, or is that a different show?
No. It's not like 21 Jump Street, but this was real. He really did that and wrote this like shocking tell-all book about high schoolers and all the crazy shit they were doing. And then Cameron Crowe adapted it into a screenplay alongside Amy Heckerling to make this movie in 1982. That's very, from what all reports, loosely based on the nonfiction book. But Fast Times was kind of a legendary movie. I mean, I remember I wasn't allowed to see it when it came out because it was famously had lots of sex and nudity and what have you. But it was also one of the first one of these type of films that, while really breaking that rated R barrier, I mean, almost barely getting a rated R for sex stuff in it. It was also doing it in a way that was through the viewpoint often of the female characters instead of the male characters, which was an interesting take.
Well, it was directed by a woman, and obviously women are more inclined to want to show women's point of view because male point of view is so often the standard. So that's not surprising.
One of the only films I can think of that, like, there's an alpha male character who finally gets the girl he's been chasing, and then he looks pathetic. What a great cast for the time. I mean, Phoebe Cates with, as this pointed out, featuring a scene with the character Judge Reinhold having a masturbation fantasy about her that literally became the masturbation fantasy for every teenage male in the United States.
And then you find out that she didn't even, I mean, and I would get why she wouldn't want to do it. She kept going, you don't need this in the film. And it becomes the one thing that even if you haven't seen this movie, like I have not seen this movie, I know that scene.
It's one of the most iconic nude scenes in film history, next to Basic Instinct and Sharon Stone, you know? despite Phoebe Cates's being a little insecure, understandably, about this pronounced nude scene in the film, it made her career after that. I mean, she was in lots of movies after that until she decided to retire from acting.
And just be Mrs. Kevin Kline, which seems like a good gig.
That scene was so iconic. She went on to be in many more films afterwards. Movie made Sean Penn, I would argue. He had been in stuff before this, but this was by far the most iconic role he had had up to this point. But this is one of those just super ridiculously quotable films that, like, I know for my generation at least, everybody went see even if they weren't supposed to and quoted endlessly. And yeah, kind of legendary, really. Have y'all seen this one?
Yes.
I have not. I have God seen damn it, Mindy. A superhero parody of it, but I have not seen the real version.
I was maybe like 12 and fast forwarded through it to see nudity. So
I was born in 83. What do you want from me?
I was born in 81. Man, there's no excuse.
So next up, we have Rock and Roll High School.
I've also seen that one. Yes.
Well, it's embarrassing for me because everyone I knew always talked about this film growing up. It came out in 1979, was famous for being the Ramones movie, you know? And when it came out, I was 9 years old. I didn't know who the fucking Ramones were. I didn't know the Ramones were till like 5 or 6 years after that, probably. I didn't end up seeing this film, although I had seen plenty of clips from it till I was in my mid-20s, probably. But I will admit, despite that, and despite how often for cult movies, especially musical-based cult movies, if you didn't see him when you were in the right age to see it, you're probably not going to really get it later. I really loved this when I saw it.
Me too. Like, I'm always a big fan of movies that have like a huge, it's about the band, you know, this is one of my go-to cult movies. I really enjoyed this one. And I didn't realize that the lead actress was like 28 at the time playing a teenager. It's just amazing.
The Ramones seemed like cool people who were just kind of bewildered that they were in a film. They weren't divas on set of the "We're the Ramones. How dare you peons come near me?" They're like, "Hey, I'm on set. Can I have some chips?"
Yeah, but I forget who they were talking to during it, who said, first off, they were very nice. All they wanted, which is bizarre, they wanted an empty room, a television, and a bag of potato chips a day.
Yeah.
But then she's like, "They're also the dumbest people I've ever met in my entire life."
They're not actors.
This segment in the documentary brings up something that I really like about Time Warp 3. Some of the people who are speaking about the movie, they're really rude in regards to speaking about other people. I think her name is Mary Wyler.
Oh, Mary Warnoff.
Yes. She talks about the Ramones in this way that's like, that's kind of rude, but like really funny. And I'm kind of liking how like she does not care that, you know, anybody might see this. I'm not sure if they shot all of these documentaries like in sequence, but it kind of seems like in this one, they were just kind of letting loose.
Well, in this one, it feels a lot more like they were deep diving. They had a lot more people who were involved with the films. They had a lot more people who this film was very significant to that time in their life when it came out. It feels like this part of the documentary got the most focus in regards to putting it together. So I'm wondering whether the guy who made the documentary just prefers comedies out of all the cult films and just sort of had to do the rest.
Might have just been easier to find people who had seen them.
That's true. Maybe true as well.
I love that the lead actress in this, PJ Souls, she was like a Halloween scream queen for me, though. I mean, she was in Carrie and Halloween.
She was the girl with the baseball cap in Carrie, right?
And I believe she's the first one to get killed in Halloween.
Yes. Yeah.
She's the slutty friend, as it were.
I thought it was so cute that she was wearing a Ramones t-shirt for her interview. That's
I've always
cute.
Gotten the impression, having seen a lot of interviews with her, because she's in so many movies from this period that I love, that she is still totally just like a geek girl for this stuff. She loves it.
Love it.
Yeah. Well, next up we have Valley Girl, which just recently got discussed again because I forget what television network it was, but they did a new musical version of it that was one of those jukebox musical styles.
Oh, yeah.
Which
yeah.
Very rarely are any good. I did not see it. I cannot discuss. I had heard positive reviews, but they were all from people who also tend to like things that regularly come on the Disney Channel that are directed at teenagers. So hard to gauge there, but I know that I just had no interest with what they were making of it. What I saw was like, well, that's not Valley Girl. That's not what that movie was. Valley Girl ended up being a considerably more interesting story of the making than I ever had any idea. This documentary, I think this is one of the most fun entries here, partially because this is Nicolas Cage, like one of his first real roles. You know, I mean, he was actually in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, but just as like a background extra.
Right, right.
And they're credited as Nicolas Coppola.
I believe that's real name.
He was credited as Cage. Yeah. They had gotten all these stupid, handsome guys, and the director was like, no, that's not what we're looking for. That's like, bring us the guy who's kind of ugly. And yet, with all that, they're interviewing the people from this movie, who's Elizabeth Daly, who's wonderful. I've always thought she's a riot, very big voice actress, mm-hmm. but she was one of the big stars of this movie. She was like, dude, we all made out with Nicolas Cage on that movie. Like, they're saying on the set, everybody made out at least once with Nicolas Cage when we were making that movie.
Well, what's interesting about this film is that they're going into, like, the plot and stuff. And it's like, I haven't seen it, but I know, obviously, the Valley Girl talk. This is, like, Romeo and Juliet, and Nicolas yeah. Cage didn't have his career start because he's a Coppola. He was living in his car. What?
Yeah.
It's yes. just, like, there was a lot more depth to Valley Girl than you would expect, both behind the scenes and in them.
Cage was one of those people who's like Joe Hill, Stephen King's son. He did not want to make it because of his family connections. Mm-hmm. He wanted to make it on his own, which is funny considering the director, Martha Coolidge, apparently said it. Neither he nor the lead actress, Deborah Foreman, could act like at all. They were horrible. And that was my memory of this film as well. Like, it's a solid as shit B-movie with just some incredibly memorable songs in it. Yeah, they're both kind of terrible.
Well, she said they couldn't act because they were actually dating.
Well, they also couldn't act.
You've seen the movie. I would have to agree with Chris, yes.
Deborah Foreman was in some other films, but certainly nothing else that made you go, oh, she's improved. She's in like Waxwork and April Fool's Day, and you're like, yeah, I can see why she decided to quit the business at some point there. Cage got better. He learned something along the way. Of course, the Plimsolls, who nobody really knew about at the time, had their huge break with this movie by being selected to be the band playing in a big prominent scene in there, playing the song A Million Miles Away, mm-hmm. which is a great fucking song. Yeah. Jukebox classic. Finding out that they weren't even the band that was supposed to be in that scene, they were supposed to get this band X, which is one of my all-time favorite bands, but they're kind of obscure. They never had a big radio hit. And watching John Doe, one of the two lead singers of it, go, we looked at the script and we said, that's so fucking stupid. And I wanted to hear him say something like, and then it turned out we were the ones who were stupid.
Yeah.
So they go on after this to Napoleon Dynamite. I had this ex who was obsessed with it, watched it over and over, and I had no idea. It was like one of those movies, I know it had come out, I missed it. Other people I'd hear talk about it from time to time, but I had no idea it had this huge cult. And she made me go with her to see it at the Alamo Draft House with John Grease there live along with some other cast members, and she was just flipping out. I mean, she's like 30 years younger than John Grease and was like totally, that was her bucket list celebrity to fuck.
No.
I was like, what? Just because of this movie. Very weird. Napoleon Dynamite is an odd film, and of all these films is... You're either just going to grok it and the way that it's being funny, or it's just not going to be your sense of humor at all, and you will never understand why other people like it. I feel glad that I do feel like I get it. I just never liked it quite as much as everyone else seemed to.
I agree with you, Chris. I liked it enough, but it exploded in a way that's like, oh, okay.
I'm glad y'all like it. Sixth grade me, when this movie came out, it blew my fucking mind. Like, I was like, I didn't know they can make movies like this. It's funny because these are weird people and they're doing seemingly just normal things. And I love this movie to this day. I think if someone has never seen an indie film and they like exclusively just watch Fast and Furious movies and like Marvel films or something, and you want to say like, hey, watch this indie comedy you might like, Napoleon Dynamite is for sure the one.
A year or so after it came out, I was working my first pre-K teacher job, and one of the kids came in and was saying, Napoleon Dynamite is stupid, and I had to like go and ask the parents because I hadn't seen it yet. I was like, is it okay for y'all to show this to a three-year-old? And like, yeah, it's fine. She didn't get it. She thought it was stupid. I'm like, okay. And then I watched it and I'm like, okay, well, that makes sense. Okay, that's fine. But that's one of my favorite stories about Napoleon Dynamite, is that this three-year-old was like, this is stupid.
Well, I mean, how could they possibly have connected with that film at 3 years old? Things I learned about this movie from this, which were interesting. First off, that dance where the lead actor gets up on stage and does this dance, I was sure that had to have been heavily choreographed. He's a really good dancer.
And he spends a good chunk of the movie watching a dance tape. So you would think that that would be
right. But yeah, it was all just him improv. Apparently that dude is actually a good dancer. So I guess you never know. Also love that he said that shirt he was wearing, he ended up trading it with someone who worked on the Harry Potter films for the Golden Snitch prop.
I loved that.
My favorite story is that John Grease, there's a scene where he in the movie throws a stake and hits Napoleon when he's riding a bike right in the face. They had to take it over and over and over again, like, and no one could hit him, and finally he's like, give me that stick, and did it first shot, because like, I used to play baseball.
Like, I can hit him, it's a moving target, I can do it.
Clerks, this movie has been discussed to death.
Yeah,
there is no amount of trivia about Clerks that Kevin Smith has not already said a billion fucking times.
Well, look at in the interview section of this film, he is wearing a shirt of himself and a pin of
a
himself.
A pin with his face.
It's like, I just wanted to face palm at that point. It's like, really, Kevin Smith? This is where you've gone.
And both the pin and the shirt have the same outfit that he's
wearing. That he's wearing right then.
It's this weird infinite loop.
The man's entire career has been about him trying to figure out what he did right in Clerks and do it again.
Fair enough.
Like, that's his whole career, and he's never done it. I mean, I'm not gonna shit on Clerks. I think Clerks is great, albeit probably a little problematic by today's standards, but it's a very funny movie with non-actors, a first-time director and writer. I mean, it's amazing that film was the hit it was, but holy God, was it a hit. The one thing in here I did not know, Miramax hired famous lawyer Alan Dershowitz to appeal the NC-17 rating to the MPAA board, which is like a riot.
It got that rating because of language, not nudity or violence.
It was pretty mouthy. They described what a snowball is. I did not know what a snowball was. I can never unhear what a snowball is.
You'll always know what a snowball is.
Sadly, I knew what it was. I just didn't know the term.
So that's what we've been doing, honey. But next up, we have Office Space. This was a big deal if you were living in Austin when it came out, because Mike Judge was our boy.
Texans are really quick to claim their own.
And I wouldn't be surprised if the only place that Office Space performed well when it first hit the theater was Austin. Yep. I mean, hell, I remember seeing his next film, Idiocracy, in the theater here. Totally sold out crowd, like going crazy. And that film bombed all over the country, and it's great.
Yeah.
But Office Space, I'd say, is decidedly his best movie of the films that he made. It's almost like a primer on how to make a cult comedy.
Well, it's based on a cartoon that he made. That I didn't know.
The cartoon was based largely just about the character Stephen Root played, who was
his stapler.
Something is wrong with his brain guy, Milton.
Mm-hmm. But the fact that the boss was so almost on the nose, they showed clips of it with the boss and him, and it's like, damn, that's pretty much exactly the same.
I saw Office Space also, I think I was in probably sixth grade.
Such a baby.
At that time, thought this was hilarious. Now, at 27, having an office job, this is even funnier than I remember.
Yeah.
There's only three movies on this whole list from this particular episode that I still go back and rewatch regularly and think hold up just as strongly as they did when they were made, and this was one of them.
For sure.
Yeah, Office Space is one of those movies, like, if it comes on, I'm watching it, it's just like, it's time to watch Office Space.
Next up, one of the other three films that I still go back and rewatch and go, this thing is still amazing, which is Christopher Guest's Best in Show.
Yeah.
Well, with Christopher Guest films, how do you pick which one is the best cult film?
That's hard.
For me, I mean, they did Spinal Tap in the first episode. This one's Best in Show. For me, as an actor, it's Waiting for Guffman.
Guest didn't direct Spinal Tap, though. That was Rob Reiner.
Okay, that's fair. It's still those people, though.
I like all of his films, even like the not generally thought of the best, A Mighty Wind. I still think it's funny as
shit. It's still delightful.
I love A Mighty Wind.
But I will tell you, this one is the one that is the most perfectly firing on all cylinders, the most laugh out loud funny, and definitely the one that if you talk to someone, if you ask them about all of Christopher Guest's directed films, if they've only seen one, it's going to be
that one. My mother raises and shows dogs, and this is like porn to her or something, because she's just like, oh, I love Best in Show.
Yeah, that's the thing about these films in particular, is like, they're funny, but if you are in that industry or in that little world, it's fucking hilarious.
It's hilarious, yeah.
I know, again, going back to Waiting for Guffman, whenever a show opens, there's a group of us going, it's the day of the show, y'all. Yeah, so it's like that happens with every one of these groups. And, you know, this one, I guess, has the biggest audience because it's just people who love dogs.
Everyone can relate to someone they know who is a little too attached to their pet.
Exactly.
There's a joke about two left feet that's worth, like, just that joke alone is worth watching the movie.
Worth pointing out to fans of Schitt's Creek that was Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara playing a married couple, and they're hysterical in there. And of course, they ended up doing that for 6 seasons of the wonderful show Schitt's Creek.
It's awesome.
And the next one is Kingpin. I don't think I saw in the theater. I didn't see it till later. I've always been very mixed about the Farrelly brothers as writer directors, where I'm like, okay, they're getting these huge hits. I just did not have as strong a positive reaction to their films as everybody else seemed to, with the possible exception of Kingpin, which I found when I finally saw it absolutely charming. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because Bill Murray plays one of the lead roles in it. I don't know. That always adds a lot to a movie for me. I mean, I certainly could give a shit one way or the other about bowling or the Amish. No offense to any Amish people who might be listening, but probably aren't, because I don't think the Amish listen to podcasts.
Only in that crazy year.
That's when they listen to all the podcasts.
All of them.
I don't know why they specifically called this one out as, of all their movies, the one that's the cult one. I mean, maybe it's just because it really did bomb when it came out and then found a new life on videotape.
You can't just make a cult film. You make a film, it doesn't find its audience right away, and then it's found later. You know, that's kind of part of it.
I think this movie's okay, but I kind of thought this segment was a little annoying, mainly just because of Peter Farrelly. He just was stroking his own ego, like, for every little bit of interview that they got out of him.
I'm a very mixed guy about the Farrelly brothers. I mean, I don't have anything against them per se, and I've liked some of the stuff they've done, but...
Who was the one who did Movie 43?
Oh, well, he's one of the many people who did Movie 43. You cannot just put that on Farrelly brothers. They were a shit ton of responsible entities for that abomination. The one interesting thing that came out of this segment was everybody's actual bowling skills, that Bill Murray apparently is such a good bowler. The scene where he gets 3 strikes in the row at the end of the movie, mm-hmm. not only did he actually do that himself, but that was all just first take. Never not confident that he could do it. He's a really good bowler.
I love Bill Murray, and I love that, you know, I'm just going to ad-lib this, and it was all gold for him, you know.
Anyway, next up is Super Troopers. This is one of those sad stories of a comedy troupe of people who made a genuinely really hysterical movie and then never even came close to getting a film that was anywhere near this good again. Mm-hmm. Even the recent sequel to Super Troopers. This is not a movie I can go back to often, but the few times I have, I've always gotten quite a few chuckles out of it. I suspect in this era that it's a little less charming and funny to see a bunch of police officers fucking with people for their own yucks.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, if anything, this is a realistic film. It's like a documentary at this point.
With more syrup chugging. Oh, God.
I just always assumed that was not real maple syrup. Yeah, there's a scene where they chug these gallons of maple syrup, and you're like, there's no way that anyone would actually do this. And they reveal, no, we did. In fact, we had to drink like 3 bottles apiece just to get the whole take. And then we're completely ill afterwards. I'm like, that's insane. I mean, at least it was clearly cheap syrup. Because if they'd had real proper maple syrup and tried to chug that, they probably would have died.
I think I saw Super Troopers way past the time that I probably should have. Finally watching it like a couple years ago, I'm smoking weed. And I was like, this is doing nothing for this movie. But for some reason, while watching it in the context of this documentary, those few clips that they showed, they were kind of cracking me up. I feel like I maybe have to revisit this one.
Definitely the one that most firmly on this list has been described as a stoner comedy, because it is quite a lot of drug jokes in this thing about people getting high. Although every movie on here has been described as a stoner comedy. I think people who don't understand what a cult film is really, so they call it, oh, I guess what stone people must find this funny. The next one is Monty Python and the Holy Grail, because of course this is probably the ultimate cult comedy film, made on a shoestring. There's practically no script. They're making it up as they go along. It's like they're sweeting the Holy Grail story with whatever they had on hand to do at the moment and making it up as they go along. And they end up with one of the most brilliant, unstoppably funny comedies of all time.
But one thing that I'm surprised that they didn't point out, because they reference this in like Point Break and, you know, Rocky Horror and all this other stuff, Spamalot is hugely successful as a result of this cult film, and yet there's not even a clip of the stage show. This thing I believe, won Tonys, and yet not even a snippet.
That's probably because the musical came along so far after the fact when it came out. I mean, it's like Airplane by the point the musical came around, where it's like everybody has seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail. You know, it's not just a cult film anymore. It's now a essential watching comedy classic.
Monty Python and the Holy Grail is how I ended up married to Michael. So it's a very special.
Whoa.
Yeah, I met a friend at a midnight showing on my birthday, became friends with this person who ultimately led me to meeting Michael's.
I'm really trying to keep myself from making a Black Knight joke.
Yeah.
Well, this movie used to freak me out as a kid. I thought this was a fucking horror movie.
So at this point, we get a little title card in the movie that says, campy. What is this going to be? So it means they're going to move into movies that, like we said earlier, these could have just as easily fit into the first segment of midnight movies. And of course, one of the first ones they show is Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, that I didn't even know about it when I was young, because I think in my head I got it mixed up between this and Valley of the Dolls, which this is not actually a sequel to, but it's made almost like a satire sequel to, sort of, okay, in a way. This was 1970. It was satirical, but not specifically of that movie per se. It was more sort of making fun of culture in general. It was also Russ Meyers, mm-hmm, who was one of the weirdest schlock masters of all time. If it wasn't for the fact he wasn't such a honest to God, really good filmmaker, his films would be relegated to a dustbin of nothing but nostalgic collectors, because they were all softcore porn. Mm-hmm. He had a thing for women with huge breasts, and all of his movies feature women with huge breasts taking their clothes off quite a bit. In the first segment, they talk about his Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. For me, this was his masterpiece, and I can't count how many times I ended up seeing this when I finally discovered it. And I only discovered it, not because of Russ Meyers, but because I was a big fan of Roger Ebert, and I found this was the one movie Ebert ever wrote, weirdly, which, if you ever get a chance to seek out the review of the movie with Siskel and Ebert on At the Movies, Siskel just trashes this film.
Oh, and it's
so fucking funny. I always put this in my head in the same category as Rocky Horror Picture Show. Mm-hmm. There are some similar qualities to it, and I almost don't want to say too much about the plot because it's insane and really fun to watch play out, but it's definitely sort of a parody of the evil hippies movies of the 60s. It's got great music. Strawberry Alarm Clock, a real life band, has a scene here that's really famous. The band in here called the Carrie Nations, that I believe ended up actually being later the name of an actual band. I bet you anything, if there's one movie on this whole list that none of y'all have seen, it's this one.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Highly recommend it. Next up, we have Showgirls.
Oh, I've seen that one.
I still don't get it.
Don't get it either.
I rewatched this recently and went, I'm sorry, this is just terrible.
It's a bad film. It's not at all good. I appreciate that the villainess, she went in thinking that it was going to be a lot classier than it was. Yeah, my character's Aphrodite and this is Cupid and here's Psyche. And he's like, what? No. And you put a lot more thought into this than anybody else. And then when she got there and realized just how trashy it was, it's like, I just want the drag queens to dress up like me on Halloween. That's all I want. At least this person did not take it too seriously. About a decade ago, I went to see Hurley Burley on Broadway, and you have Elizabeth Berkley playing Nomi in Hurley Burley, and it's just like, oh, is this the role that you're relegated to the rest of your life?
I mean, this movie was not her fault.
I know.
It was not the fault of anyone involved except for Joe Esterhaus, the schlock master, but not in a good way, who made this film, because he was riding super high after the enormous success of his movies Flashdance, mm-hmm, Jagged Edge, yep, and of course Basic Instinct, that he was handed a blank check, do whatever the fuck you want to do as a writer, and then given to Paul Verhoeven, who was also in exactly the same scenario, which just made a series of really huge hits. They're like, yeah, do whatever. And they thought this was going to be epic. And this movie cost a decent amount of money, mm-hmm, $45 million at that time, pretty big budget considering it wasn't a sci-fi movie or anything,
yeah,
filled with sex and nudity, NC-17.
But in a way, that's just gross.
Ended up winning 7
Razzies.
Razzies, which was the highest amount any film had ever gotten and totally deserved. And to this day, the single worst sex scene in the history of film.
It's
like
so
the hot tub scene between Kyle MacLachlan and Elizabeth Berkley.
The lap dance looks like she's having a seizure.
I always say it looks like a fish dying.
It is. Yeah. She's flopping around and it's like, is this supposed to be erotic? I don't.
People love it now. I have more than one friend who's like, no, I'm sorry. I think this movie was honestly great. I think people totally didn't get it. And this documentary makes that argument. I'm like, I'm sorry. I did go back and try. I tried.
Yeah. Well, I remember being 13 and being a big fan of it. So I'm going to guess I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10.
So then we have Plan 9 and Glenn or Glenda. They chose to sort of mash up two Ed Wood films to talk about because you've got to discuss Ed Wood films. And, you know, obviously Plan 9 from Outer Space, often on lists, worst movie ever made. Mm-hmm. But the guy makes a solid point here in the documentary. How can it be the worst movie ever made if people keep going back and wanting to rewatch it over and over again?
That's
and
true.
That is a valid point. Yep.
I have not seen this, even though I tried twice. I fell asleep.
Just watch the movie Ed Wood.
I've seen that. Ed Wood seems like such a sweet, passionate, caring person. The fact mm-hmm. that he was put here because his movies are something to be made fun of.
They are terrible.
I mean, they are not good, but at least acknowledge that he was this beautiful person. And I appreciated they mentioned that in Glenn and Glenda and him dealing with being a transvestite. Actually, those little clips that they showed, I want to watch Glenn and Glenda for serious, not just to make fun of it. Ed Wood should have had a more reverential treatment in this documentary because he was such a nice person.
I know, but that doesn't have anything to do with how your art is. There's plenty of really big assholes who make amazing art and plenty of really nice people who make terrible art. And Ed was a really nice guy who made terrible art. Yeah. I mean, he is one of the worst film directors of all time. The movie does its best to be nice about it, but it's the definition of campy. People go back and appreciate it because it's so laughably horrible. It's amazing that a copy even still exists. I think of the campy and cult films, the best thing on this list is probably Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which is the next one, which is the third movie that, man, I go back and I rewatch this one regularly.
They should have acknowledged the stage show. That's all I'm saying.
Once again, stage show had nothing to do with its cult status.
It wouldn't have been made into a movie if it weren't a play first.
Every other time they mentioned a play of a movie, it was because of the cult status. And I didn't think it was relevant in this particular case.
They could have at least shown its name.
It is fantastic. This is a great movie. Obviously, it's not for everyone. If you don't like movies or if you're extremely uncomfortable with trans issues, which, you know, seriously, wake up.
Fuck
what
you.
What year are you in? Stop being a child.
Yeah, basically.
It's some great of my favorite music. Songs from any movie ever. I mean, Criterion put this out. It's nice that if anyone's watching this looking for cult movies to watch they haven't seen yet, Hedwig's essential. Yeah.
The segment with Hedwig is one of the best parts of this movie because it introduces me to a movie that I'm pretty sure I've seen at Blockbuster and just have never looked into. I'm going to be looking forward to watching these.
That's exactly what the director wanted. Mm-hmm. So there you go, you sucker. Got it. You fell for it.
You win.
The movie on here I haven't seen for the longest is the next one, which is Female Trouble. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, John Waters is part of their crew sitting here talking about it. It's not really surprising they let John Waters double dip. And to be honest, I think this is a way more watchable Waters film than Pink Flamingos is. For one thing, it's a little later, looks a lot cleaner. The plot is a little more of a plot, such as it is. It's still completely disgusting and unpleasant, but at least this one, I get why people would want to watch it over and over again. Has anybody else here seen this one?
Not when I was supposed to. I had never heard of this movie before when I saw it. Also, you know what? All the bad stuff, I guess, started in sixth grade because it's another one that I was just browsing through IFC. I see, oh, rated R, or like, I think NC-17 for nudity. I was like, oh, I'm going to see and watch what this is.
Not nudity anyone would what want to actually see.
First 10 minutes and I am traumatized.
John Waters is always like, oh, we'll have nudity. They're just of literally the ugliest people we could find. Yeah. No offense to any ugly people who might be listening. I'm sure someone finds you beautiful. Oh, anyway. Let's move on to our last one, which is Eating Raoul. My parents turned me on to this one, weirdly. This very prudish couple, the director, and then once again, that star we were talking about earlier, Mary Woronov from Rock and Roll High School, where they're a prudish married couple that decides they're going to murder and eat swingers and, you know, sex perverts, as they call them. And it is a riot, or at least it was that I remember it. I haven't seen it in a long time.
That's one I have not seen. I've seen a lot of cult films. I have not seen that one. I'll check it out because it made the list, but
it's decidedly not a horror film. Like, there's no gore or anything in it. Mm-hmm. It's not that kind of movie. Right. It's playing it straight up just for laughs in almost a sort of innocent way. They showed the best scene in the whole movie, though, where he gets mad at a whole hot tub full of swingers and throws like a electric heater into it and they all die at once, just flop over the side. So definitely the most iconic sequence of that film. Yeah. But yeah, you should see it if you haven't seen it.
Okay.
There's a kind of funny, also kind of like uncomfortable story that they tell. Nobody went to go see it, so much to the point that the director and Mary went to a screening of it.
Oh, yeah.
And he was buying cookies and passing it out to the audience to like make sure that they stay and to like to thank them for even just being in line.
This one, I think, took a while to find an audience. So our last movie, as they switched to a title card saying cult movies today, which is so weird that you could do a whole thing just about modern day cult films for like sure. Last 10 years.
Well, this part was the one part where the panel really confused me, because throughout this entire thing, they've been pretty much inconsequential, you know, having a comment here or there to the point of being really irritating. But in this one, he's like looking at the camera as though that's the person he's talking to. They're making a big deal about cult movies in modern day. And it's like, why are you setting this up like this?
At that point, there's like 10 minutes left of the movie, and it makes you think like it's going to be a whole nother segment.
And then it's just the one movie, yep. Which is The Room.
I am also mad that they didn't also mention Clue as being a cult movie that you also are interactive with at the theater, but whatever.
For possible future installments, if you're going to talk about another movie, if it has a musical, please show a snippet of it or else...
Show the musical! Or
Mindy's going to lose her goddamn mind.
I will be
mind.
Mad. I want to sing along, damn it.
In case you didn't know, ladies and gentlemen, Mindy has a bit of agenda when it comes to theatrical performances in film.
It's not like I am casting myself in them all the time and singing their soundtracks. That's pretty much the only music I listen to. Shut up! Don't you judge me.
Don't tell me about what you do in the shower. I don't want to hear
I have
that.
Awards, anyway, damn you.
The shower, and the soap award goes to... sorry,
people
I'm sure
make,
you do have awards.
People give me money to do this, damn you.
Stop, seriously. I'm just teasing. You make it so easy for me, Mindy. I'm sorry. No, The Room.
The Room. What can you say about The Room? I mean, they made a whole movie about the movie.
I saw that first.
I saw The Room because I saw the trailers for Disaster Artist, and I'm like, I have to watch this movie first in order to understand watching Disaster Artist. And The Room did not fucking disappoint. I remember I watched it, and then my sister, I mentioned to my sister, and she's like, you didn't watch it with the riff tracks? Which I did later. But it's like, you don't need riff tracks to enjoy this film. It is so what the fuck. It just fills your heart with joy. Wonderfully bad.
I love that they make the argument in here that Tommy Wiseau genuinely thought he was going to be the new Brando. And
he
that's
did.
Like the explanation for why he does his lines the way that he does, that he thinks he's doing it like Brando would. Ugh. And you're like, wow, that guy is just flat out insane.
Oh, and I yeah. love the fact that they all called him out, because Wiseau has said, it's like, oh yeah, I totally planned on making this a cult film and totally planned on it. It's like, no, you did not. You did not. Stop lying.
He famously was very angry about the reaction to yes. him at first. This is a nice little tribute in the sense that they get almost everybody who is interviewed with other films to come on and say, oh my God, The Room. It's like the one where like everyone else who's been in the rest of the segment comes out of the woodwork to go, oh my God, The Room, you got to see The Room. And saying that, like, there's one film that like we can all agree, no question, is like the cult film of the past decade. It's The Room.
Right. That's true. Absolutely yeah. The Room.
Every other weekend you can go to the Music Box Theater here in Chicago and see a midnight screening of it. It's still there.
I'm actually surprised there isn't a play of that people have done yet. I would do a theatrical fake sequel to it.
Oh.
But yeah, there's a lot of stuff I feel like that was in this whole series. It was very much worth watching, especially as Adrian pointed out, like just a list of stuff that maybe you haven't seen it mm-hmm. that is worth checking out. But we have been going super long, so we will go to final thoughts, which means keep it short, people. Mindy, I'm looking at you. Keep it short, and I'll give you the soap award.
I earned it. I think this film did a lot better in regards to organizing which films it chose and having them be more deep dives, which made that much more engaging and less like, here's a synopsis, let's move on, let's move on, let's move on. So I did appreciate that they did that better. But I thought the panel was even weirder in this one, which was rather distracting. The organization of this and the analysis of this was better than the others. I still wish they could have done more. So I am going to give it 8 out of 10 times I did not hit her. I did not. It's bullshit. Oh, hi, Mark.
When I saw that after Disaster Artist was at South By with the whole cast of the Disaster Artist and the whole cast of The Room sitting right behind me and the theater, and then they played The Room right after the Disaster Artist.
Oh, wow. And
nice. That was a meta weird experience. Adrian.
This one was a little disappointing in the sense that the interviews had no mention of the Stanislavski method. I missed those stories.
Fuck you.
But aside from that, I really like this one, actually. I would say more than the other two. And I think part of that comes from the fact that I'm not that well-versed with, I guess, what would be considered cult comedy movies. Like, I'm definitely the horror person. This gave me a lot of movies that I want to go check out ASAP. Altogether, I found it the most enjoyable. I'm not sure if it was just maybe the people that it got for this particular section just seemed more energetic and seemed like they were really letting loose. And the entire thing, this runs at 2 hours, and I never felt bored. More like this, please. I would give this 3.5 out of 5 spoons thrown at the wall during the Room screening.
Harmony?
All in all, I really enjoyed this installment of our series. I was personally just, I think, starting to fade towards the end of camp just because I hadn't seen as many of the camp films as I had seen of the comedy films. But all in all, I really enjoyed it. Love John Cleese, love Fred Willer, who are both in this. It was a lot of fun. You know, there's not like a whole lot you can say about it that's different than the other reviews. I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10 murdered or missing people who have been eaten by a prudish couple.
You know, I think if I have any problem with this one, it's just that because these films are so much more high profile in many ways than many of the other films they've discussed, that a lot of this stuff I've already seen or heard said in other places.
Right.
Like almost all these films have really good quality Blu-rays out for them with extensive discussions of this film and trivia tracks and what have you. Fun to see the refreshers, though, nonetheless. I definitely thought this was fun to watch.
Yep.
For me, it's just on kind of on the same level as the previous two. I do think that like it was weird that this is the one that really made it seem clear that their crew of people talking to each other didn't even watch some of the other films in the previous series because they had nothing to say about it. And this one, because they talked so much about everything, it was clear they had. So it's like, you know, I think if you're getting people to do a documentary and discuss films, they probably should have been required to watch everything or at least say something.
That's
to take
fair.
A paycheck. So I'm going to give this 7 out of 10 sets of glistening Phoebe Kate breasts.
7.
Oh, wait. No,
wait,
no, no.
Doesn't work.
No, I change it. 7 out of 10 Jim Gaffigan cameos, meow.
Oh, God.
Meow, why did you say that? Meow, what are we going to do? Meow.
Okay, no, no, no.
We're not doing the cat game, Mindy. I've told you about this.
Yeah, you gotta meow? Be kidding me.
Oh,
I sang God. Cats at the beginning, and now we're not doing the cat game. That...
Oh, God. Meow. I was trying to do a callback to that with memories.
Oh, man.